People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And as I'm sure you know by now, the big musical event here in December is Matilda the Musical, which Peter Turin is putting on, a stage musical based on the 1988 children's novel of the same name by Roald Dahl. And it was adapted by Dennis Kelly with music and lyrics by Tim Minchin. The musical's narrative centers on Matilda, a precocious 5-year-old girl with a gift of telekinesis, who loves reading, overcomes obstacles caused by her family and school, and who helps her teacher to reclaim her life. It had a 12-week run staged at the Royal Shakespeare Company from November 2010 to January 2011. It's had its West End premiere, it's been at the Cambridge Theatre, it's won numerous awards as well. And the person who's been costume and set designer right from the beginning is Rob Howell, who's been flown out to be part of this production as well. And Rob Howell is with me here in the studio. Rob, welcome. And I gather it's a warm welcome to Cape Town as well, because you're one of those Cape Town virgins. You've never
been
here
before.
That's right,
I've never been here before, but it's very nice to be here in December and the sun is shining. Because I've come in from London and I can tell you the sun isn't shining in London. So, it's very nice to be here. I've only been here a day, so I'm still finding my feet. But
okay. And I should also think something of a culture shock, because I know you've taken this musical all around the world.
Yes.
But here you are right on the tip of Africa now, which
yes.
must be different from anywhere else,
yes.
possibly.
Yes. Well, as I say, I'm still finding my feet, but I can already tell I'm going to have a very exciting and it's a beautiful...
Are you going to get to see any of the countryside, do you think?
Well, I'm hoping to go out to Gora for a short safari in about a week's time with my two sons who are here with me.
Okay.
And so if we can make that work, that would be great before going back home to London next week.
Okay. What, before we start talking about Matilda the Musical as a musical and all about it and its many stories and about you, you have been involved with this for a very long time, haven't you?
Matilda specifically, it's probably... I guess 10 or 11 years. I mean, these things take a long time because there's a tremendous amount of sort of equal measure of confidence and uncertainty. And Roald Dahl wrote this book as a series of separate... I mean, there's one narrative, obviously, but there's a series of separate chapters which were specifically for bedtime stories. So on a Monday night, you did chapter one and on it would go. And that's great for something for parents and children to enjoy. It's not necessarily great for a musical because there is a sort of defined break in the structure. Mm-hmm. So to make it work for a musical, there was a lot of work that needed to be done by Dennis Kelly, who wrote the book for the musical, which is a separate thing to the book that Roald Dahl wrote.
Okay. And did Roald Dahl agree to this, do you know?
His estate did, yes.
Oh, of course he would have done it.
With writers as established as Roald Dahl, you can't go anywhere near their work without their estate sort of allowing things to continue, and at different points along the process they didn't do this, but if they wanted to, they could have stopped the thing if they were unhappy in the way that it was going. So Dennis set to work way before any of us were involved, trying to work out what he would call the glue in between these separate chapters would be, so that when you're sitting in the theatre and it's a musical, it doesn't feel chopped up, it feels like one thing. And then when he'd done his work, it felt like there was a book for a musical, but there was no music and there was no lyrics, but there was a shape to it. And Dennis had invented stitched into the musical, a separate story for Matilda, which is the glue that runs through it. And so when you see the musical, there's a sort of fantasy story that Matilda imagines in her head. And that is not actually in the Roald Dahl.
Oh, I see. Okay. So how did the music then come into view?
Well, then when there was confidence, the confidence level had gone up and the anxiety levels had gone down a little bit because there was a book that existed. That's when the creative team starts to get to be considered by the Royal Shakespeare Company. Given that we now know the tone of this book for the musical, who would be the best director and who would be the best choreographer and the set designer, costume designer, lighting designer, sound designer. And as a group, we start to... And it's not the same on every show. This is a sort of messy business that... and there's a lot of fumbling around in the dark to arrive at a creative team. And obviously, with pre-existing works, the music and the lyrics is already there. But with a new musical, there was no music, there's no lyrics. So alongside the search for the creative team, the search for composer and lyricist, if it was going to be one person or mates, quite often it's two different people. So that started as well, and that will sort of could lead me onto the first music choice.
Yes, I'm dying to see what you've chosen.
Tim Minchin, as an idea, came up. Tim was getting to be very well known, but he wasn't obviously as well known as he is now. And he was well known for being naughty, slightly rude, and very funny comedian who was emerging. His comedy was all stitched into it. He's a brilliant self-taught pianist. But he wasn't really, he wasn't necessarily an obvious choice. There was a, so I went with Matthew Watchers, who directed Matilda. We went to see Tim, a gig that Tim did at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London. And Tim did his first act, and he was very funny, very rude, and we had a great time. And then he came on and did his second act. Very funny, very rude, we had a great time. And at the end, blackout, and Matthew said to me, he leant over and he said, "He's not right." And I said, "What do you mean he's not right? We've had the best time." He said, "I don't think he can make anybody cry."
Oh, that's interesting.
He hadn't made us cry. Anyway, the crowd are going crazy. It's still in the blackout. And Tim comes on to do his encore, and he performs White Wine in the Sun, which is a love letter. Tim is Australian, but he's living in London at the time. And White Wine in the Sun is a love letter to his daughter. And being Australian, he's considering what it is to be in London in the cold and the grey, as we discussed earlier, whilst his family, his mum and dad and aunties and uncles, in Sydney, drinking white wine in the sun at Christmas. And you think, as with a lot of Tim's music, it's just going to start, and he's very funny, witty and rude about Christmas and all of that. And then he introduces his daughter, and it's a tremendously moving twist, and I defy anybody not to cry.
And this is what we're going to hear. This is the song he wrote.
White Wine in the Sun.
I really like Christmas. It's sentimental, I know, but I just really like it. I'm hardly religious. I'd rather break bread with Dawkins than Desmond Tutu, to be honest. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to consumerism, to the commercialization of an ancient religion, to the westernization of a dead Palestinian press ganged into selling PlayStations and beer. But I still really like it. Forward to Christmas, though I'm not expecting a visit from Jesus. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I don't go in for ancient wisdom. I don't believe just cause ideas are tenacious, it means that they're worthy. I get freaked out by churches. Some of the hymns that they sing have nice chords, but the lyrics are dodgy. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to the miseducation of children who in tax-exempt institutions are taught to externalize blame and to feel ashamed and to judge things as plain right or wrong.
but I quite like the songs. I'm not expecting big presents. The old combination of socks, jocks, and chocolates is just fine by me. 'Cause I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. Safe in this world, my sweet blue-eyed girl. And if my baby girl, when you're 21 or 31 and Christmas comes around, and you find yourself 9,000 miles from home, you'll know what. Sisters and me and your mum will be waiting for you in the sun. Whenever you come, your brothers and sisters, your aunts and your uncles, your grandparents, cousins, and me and your mum will be waiting for you in the sun. Wine in the sun, darling, when Christmas comes, we'll be waiting for you in the sun, drinking white wine in the sun, waiting for you in the sun, waiting for you. It's sentimental, I know.
A piece called White Wine in the Sun, written by Tim Minchin, who is in fact the composer of the score of Matilda the musical, which is playing here at Artscape. And the first choice of my guest, who is Rob Howell, the set designer and costume designer of Matilda. Not only this particular production, but productions way back. And that song, Rob, did not go into the show, did it?
No, it's part of Tim's act. And I think he's considered almost retiring that song because he's asked to do it so often. It's okay. Such a beautiful. And he tended to, as he did with, in our experience, close his live gigs with it. But it did prove to us that having made everybody laugh for the previous 2 hours and be witty and rude and all that stuff, mm-hmm. he could, and then after 10 minutes later, we're all bawling our eyes out. So that was a more than obvious clue that he was going to be right for Matilda. And then we all started, and then we go back to the sort of the darkness of, it's all very well having Tim as a composer and a lyricist, but he has nothing because he's got to start work now. That's when the work starts. So we've got the book for the musical, and we've got Matthew and me, but we've got nothing without the music. So.
Yes.
And it's sort of exhilarating but scary time for all of us. So I start to have some early sketch ideas. I work in a studio. We have at the time I think there was 5 of us, and I do some scribbles, and I give the scribbles to my assistants, and they make basic models, which go on to prove that my scribbles were a bad idea. I do more scribbles, and on it goes. And yeah. We are fumbling around in the dark. And alongside that, Tim's writing his music and coming in with a sketch and playing on the piano, hating it, walking out depressed and coming back a week later and liking something. But it might only be like four bars.
Wow.
But those four bars could be a clue to me as to where I could nudge, you know, my fumblings. And,
yes.
And of course, they're a clue to the choreographer as to... And also the tone, you know, is as Tim's composing, does the tone of what he's written fit that moment in that, and therefore does the, as it were, the problem then, or the challenge, go back to Dennis, who's written the book, and he can alter things to make a slightly bigger gap for Tim's bustling number. And we're all sharing, and there's plenty of opportunities.
And being flexible by the sound of things, which I suppose you have to be.
That's right. And there's plenty of opportunities for us all to fall out. And it's quite common for that to be the case, because it is scary to be asked to create something and to have nothing and to spend time with nothing. And then you're asked to be brave and show something, which is, of course, revealing something about yourself. And you need to do that. You need a sort of safe, as it were, safe environment, which is a group of trusted colleagues. So we're all roughly about the same age. We've all roughly grown up together. We've definitely all worked on shows together before. And this, what's sort of lazily termed the shorthand, is pretty well in place. So, and we all see the same shows that we haven't worked on ourselves, but we've all got similar reference points. And it's a sort of act of faith. You sort of jump into this together.
Absolutely.
And see where we can.
And also with the, it must be very challenging doing a musical, because musicals, when you think of the big musicals, that,
yes.
And you obviously think of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Les Mis and all those
yes.
things, even back to My Fair Lady, The Sound of Music, these shows demand a lot. The audience expects it to be blown away.
Well, I think it's, I mean, the what's thrilling and terrifying about working on a stage musical is that every element has to arrive at the same place together at precisely the right time.
Yes.
And that you can find many examples, by the way, some of which I've worked on, so I'm not claiming that we've got all the answers here, but it the reason why we're all so proud of Matilda is that we all set off on this journey together not really knowing. And I think it's true that all of the disciplines, with the choreography, lighting, sound, set, costume, music, lyrics, and the spoken word in the book, and of course the direction, which is holding all this, we are all arriving at the same place at the same time. No, we're not waiting for the other. You know, the choreography fits.
Yes,
it literally fits into the scenery.
Right.
I mean, quite literally, and everything arrives at the same time, and that's what you're after with a musical stage production: is that everything rises and falls as one.
Rob, when did you get involved with Matilda? How did that happen?
I first worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company 25 years ago, and I was the resident design assistant. And so I lived in Stratford-upon-Avon. And I was pretty well straight out of college. And there's one resident design assistant, and there's three resident directors, assistant directors, one of which was Matthew. And he'd pretty well left college at the same time, so he was around about the same age, employed by the RSC to live in Stratford and look after me, looking after the design of the shows, and him to look after the direction. So we knew each other then, and we did some small little studio shows together. And we've sort of grown up together, having left the RSC. And over the course of the next 25 years, did shows together at various different places, at the National Theatre, in the West End, and abroad. And then it was the RSC that was developing this script with Dennis. And when they sat down to think who would be the right director for this, Matthew's on every list at the moment, but he was understandably on the top of their list. And not because it's a cute idea, but it just turned into a nice bit of, a completing of a circle, that we ended up, Matthew and I, back in Stratford, opening Matilda, and with a whole group of people who we worked with 25 years in the production departments and stuff. And I mean, not because it was cute, but it was a very pleasing return, as it were.
Absolutely.
And that's not because it's turned out to be successful. It just seemed to make sense. It's another one of those things I mentioned earlier about everything coming together. I'm not sure it would have had the same DNA if it had been somewhere else. It might have been good for different reasons, but it just seemed to fit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's time for a piece from the show now,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah.
I see your next piece, Rob.
This is Naughty. And this is, I was talking earlier about when we're all digging around in the dark, not knowing whether we've got anything or not, and then being brave enough to share it. And I remember very clearly Tim coming into a rehearsal room. He was late for a meeting and he was stressed. He'd got off public transport. And anyway, his mood wasn't settled. And he sort of threw himself down at the piano. And I think he played just like, I don't know, 12 bars or something of Naughty. And as he was doing it, you could see uncertainty and he was almost despising what he was playing, unbeknownst to the rest, to him, that we all knew that this was gold. So here's Naughty from the show.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. So they say the subsequent fall was inevitable. They never stood a chance, they were written that way. Innocent victims of their story. Like Romeo and Juliet, 'twas written in the stars before they even met. That love and fate and a touch of stupidity would rob them of the hope of living happily. The endings are often a little bit gory. I wonder why they didn't just change their story. We're told we have to do what we're told, but surely sometimes you have to be a little bit naughty. Just because you find that life's not fair, it doesn't mean that you just have to grin and bear it. If you always take it on the chin and wear it, nothing will change. Even if you're little, you can do a lot. You mustn't let a little thing like little stop you. If you sit around and let them get on top, you might as well be saying you think that it's okay, and that's not right.
Thank you.
That's from the show Matilda the Musical, a piece called Naughty, and it was the choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, Rob Howell, the British costume and set designer who's responsible for that in Matilda, running here at Artscape. Rob, you know, you mentioned Stratford-upon-Avon and the Royal Shakespeare Company and all that, and that you worked there.
Yes.
Am I completely wrong in thinking that all they ever do there is Shakespeare, or is it a thoroughly...
You're not completely wrong. You're allowed to be as wrong as you are, because, you know, there's a clue in the name of the company. But as, you know, they do new plays, mm-hmm. and it's not just Shakespeare. It's predominantly, you know, the canon.
Right.
And there's this sort of... the audiences expect when they turn up in Stratford, which is a bit of a journey outside of London, and... Mm-hmm. So, you know, Shakespeare is the reason to go, but you'll find other stuff on and they do it very well and with equal sort of energy. It's not, you know, the new plays aren't seen as, you know, they're not done reluctantly.
So you have therefore worked on a lot of Shakespeare plays?
Yes, I mean, when I was the assistant designer there, I'd be working on 19 shows in a year.
Good grief, that's quite a lot.
It's a lot, but it was, you know, it was hard work, but it was luxury further education for me, because there's a lot of variety in 19 different shows. And Matthew would be doing the same. And
remind me of Matthew's surname. Matthew Warchus.
Warchus.
Who's the director.
He's the director, yes.
And he directed this production as well.
He did, yeah. And, you know, directors, it's a quite often confusion about what a director does, and it sometimes gets sort of blurred with producing, and they are very different jobs. And the best directors I've worked with, and Matthew's, of course, amongst those, if not the best, it's possible to leave the rehearsal room at the end of the day thinking, what did they do? And then, at the end of the week, you realise what they actually have done. But it's a sort of, almost a dark art.
Yeah, yeah. And rather like a conductor of an orchestra.
That's right, yeah.
But Rob, just tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get into this whole theatre thing?
Well,
because it sounds like you've been in it, as you said, pretty well all your life.
Well, I have. I mean, it was a strange thing for me, because there's no theatre in my family at all. My parents got nothing to do with theatre, my brother and sister. But my dad used to entertain businessmen from abroad. Before he decided where to take them, to which show to take them to, he'd take us as a family to see these shows.
Oh, to sort of do a recce,
yes,
as it were.
So we got to see lots of shows, sometimes very reluctantly, I might say. But anyway, we saw a lot. And then I remember clearly, like it was yesterday, there was one show, and I'm afraid I'll never tell anybody what the show is. But I sat there, probably slightly reluctantly, and I looked at the stage, and I thought, wow, somebody does that. That shiny curtain isn't always there, and she's just walked on stage wearing an amazing dress. You can't buy those in the shops. Somebody's made that, and if somebody's made it, somebody's told them what to make and in what colour. And in one evening I realised that all the lights aren't normally pointing where they're pointing tonight. That's another job. And then I realised that I could see the speakers, and therefore somebody's working out the sound. And it was this sort of revelation.
How old were you at the time?
15.
Oh, okay.
And I just thought, what an amazing thing to do. Mm. And I was drawing a lot when I was at school. And it is true that from that night, I knew what I wanted to do. And so every education decision I had to make about choices of courses and stuff like that was from that moment of sort of revelation. So I did I followed the normal education route, did a degree in theatre design, basically spent the next 8-9 years training. And then I left college and ended up at the Royal Shakespeare Company, which was very lucky. And then I embarked on and I was being paid at the RSC, which is an interesting thing, because it's quite hard to leave paid employment in order to, you know, the sheer cliff. Mm. When you're a young theatre designer, you go from earning money on a Friday to earning no money on a Monday.
Yes.
And it's a brave thing to do, and a lot of people who go through the college system get work as assistants and are paid, but it's very hard to make that decision to say, I'm not going to earn money on Monday. I'm going to do my own work. Anyway, maybe foolishly at the time, I decided that that's what I was going to do, and very, very little money for a long time, and then gradually started to do shows, and I'm freelance looking after myself, and the whole thing, if it goes well, sort of snowballs, and the shows get bigger and the budgets get bigger. And
you like this fit analogy, don't you? Because it does work, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, and don't forget, Matthew's people like Matthew doing the same thing. He's getting no money, and then he does small shows.
Yeah.
And your contact list grows, and the whole thing hopefully mushroom into something else. But it's not a certain path. And it can be scary financially and lonely artistically.
Yeah.
And a lot of people get lost along the way, you know.
Well, you must have had something going for you because it seems to have been a huge success, quite apart from Matilda, and we'll talk about some of the things you've done. And you've won 3 Olivier Awards. So clearly you chose the right decision, Rob.
Well, that's for other people to say. But
the proof of the pudding and all that.
It's, I've had a lot of luck, and I hope I haven't let too many people down.
Oh, good. So let's have another piece of music now.
Yes. Well, talking about luck, I ended up, you know, being a freelance theatre designer, you get, if you do have some luck and fair wind behind you, you get asked to work at different theatres, of course, around the country and sometimes around the world. And I was delighted when Richard Eyre, Sir Richard Eyre, asked me to design Carmen at the Metropolitan Opera.
The opera?
Yeah. And I sort of brought it along today because I didn't really know Carmen any more than we all know Carmen. And I didn't realise that I knew it as well as I did. And people kept saying to me, you do know it's the first musical, don't you? And I had never thought of it like that. But when I sat down to listen to it, which I have to do for my work anyway, that's not a tough job, is it, to sit down and listen?
Well, sometimes it can be. Yeah.
Well, when I sat down to listen to what was going on structurally with it, not, I'm no musicologist, but I need to know what's, you know, where the music is and where the music isn't, where the scenes are, what the rhythm of the music is going into a scene change, and there's a lot of combing through that I need to do. And then I realised what that meant. It's the first movie, because it sort of is, actually. You go for a long time before there's something that you don't recognise, or there isn't some sort of earworm that you've heard before.
Mm.
And then, at the top of Act 3, there's the most beautiful, beautiful sound. There's the entr'act at the top of Act 3, which is familiar, but it's familiar because of its beauty. It's not familiar because of the sex and the death and the heat of the rest of the piece. And it's like a sort of shining jewel for me. And I'll never forget being in the auditorium at the Met, which is an incredible room, and the first orchestra corps were there, and this started, and, you know, the curtain went up, and I stopped looking at what I was doing. You know, I got over 100 people on stage in all of my costumes. I should have had my notebook out, but I just couldn't. I just had to listen to this piece. Thank you.
music from Carmen by Georges Bizet, the soundtrack to Act 3. And another choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, Rob Howell, who's in town as the set and costume designer for Matilda the Musical, which is running here at Artscape and which has had, as we've discovered, such an amazingly successful career and won endless awards. And now we get to see it here in Cape Town. And also a bit of touch of opera there from my guest who ended up at the Metropolitan designing Carmen. That must have been
tough, isn't
an
it?
Experience.
Yeah, well, it's often said about big auditories like that, that you know, they make the hairs on your arm stand up, and you can resist it if you like, but it is true.
Absolutely.
Gosh. And, you know, it's a sort of weird alchemy.
Yeah. I've never been to the Met yet.
It's phenomenal.
And I'd love to go. I've seen it. You know, we get those HD films.
Yes.
It looks amazing. But you know what, Rob, before we run out of time completely, I really want you to tell me what it looks like. I haven't seen it yet. Or by the
Matilda.
Time this interview goes out, I will have seen it.
Yes.
But I haven't seen Matilda. So I've seen some pictures, I've seen some clips, and tell me what.
Well, when
what
I started, I mean, Matilda is a young girl who enjoys reading and is very comfortable at school learning. And in just saying what I've just said, there are two clues to a for a designer there. Enjoys reading, so you'd say books.
Yes.
Very comfortable at school. You'd say, well, the schoolroom, classroom, what else is in there? A blackboard, desks. And so I set off feeling quite pleased with myself, thinking that I would use desks. And the desk lids would open and things would pop out. And, you know, I spent 3 months probably pushing away at this idea, pretending to myself and everybody around me that desks was a good idea. And maybe somebody else could have made that work. But I knew that I was pushing away at something that wasn't really delivering. I think I did manage to persuade quite a lot of people that it would be okay, but I knew in my heart that it wasn't going to work. And that is when you've really got to be brave. And I threw it all out. So I went from having quite a lot of stuff, solutions to quite a lot of problems, to having none whatsoever. And that's when you need the support of somebody like Matthew, and because he's invested somewhat, and the choreography department has, and everybody. You know, so I've shown some people some ideas, some sketches, some basic models. So to say I'm going to get rid of all of that is obliging them to rethink as well.
Yeah.
So another period of loneliness and anxiety, and then I landed on this idea of alphabet tiles, because an alphabet tile, you know, the most familiar, it would be a Scrabble tile, but anyway, a game of alphabet tiles has the same potency. If I have the letter A on a tile in my hand, my mind is already starting to think of the beginning, the middle, or the end of a word to play with that letter A.
A la Scrabble.
A la Scrabble. And if you put the letter B in the hand of a six-year-old, their mind is doing the same thing, beginning, middle, end of a word. And here I go, you put it in the hand of a 96-year-old, the same game's being played. And that's a tremendously rich texture to have, that if you can ask an audience to be in the room with something that has equal potency across a very wide age range, then everybody's subliminally playing the same game. And that was a massive key for me. It meant that the world of our musical, which is a fantasy world, of course, there's nothing about Matilda the Musical which is social realism. So, and it's a musical, and it's my job to get some colour and life and magic into the space. And I just felt that I could do that with using alphabet tiles. And that, the geometry of that tile became a clue to, you know, all the doors that they walk through are made up of square tiles, and it just, the floodgates, as it were, open then. And
a eureka moment.
Well, a bit, almost, yes. Yeah.
And it's so different from the desks.
Yeah, and you know, we still have desks in the show, but they're school desks. They're not delivering the idea for the production.
Right.
So you, as a designer, you're tending to, in the early days, I wander around looking for what I call the holding space. Like, what is the space that's holding this story, which isn't about the rooms that they're in or the doors that they open? What is the space around them that keeps the whole mood of the tone of the piece in the air for the audience? And alphabet tiles did it for me. It meant I could get colour in, because you're not changing the identity of an alphabet tile if it's pink or yellow or blue. It's still got a letter A or B. Yeah. And yet you can drain all the colour out of it, and it can be blonde wood, and it's a familiar a la Scrabble tile. So it can be familiar, and it can have fantasy and colour and life. And that's really, you know, after a long period of, pretending to myself that it was going to be okay and it wasn't, there was a period of time being brave. And then there was a sort of rush of relief that there was something that could deliver an answer to the many problems that we hadn't yet encountered, actually. You know, this is at very early days.
Is this basically, is it the main scene or are there different scenes?
There's lots of different scenes. But I think if you asked anybody, once you've seen the show, to describe it, you would come away saying there's alphabet tiles everywhere. Yeah. But, you know, no, we go to different interiors and exteriors, school playgrounds, classrooms, bathrooms, and, you know, we deliver everything that Roald Dahl asks. The story.
I saw one of the pictures you see is a whole lot of swings.
Yes.
With children in the swings.
Well, you know, if we had more time, I would have chosen another number from the show, but it seemed a little bit obvious to do that. But there's a great number at the top of Act Two called When I Grow Up.
Okay.
And the choreographer's idea was to do swings, use swings for that. And they beautifully support what Tim has written. But when your audience see the show, you have to consider that the pendulum point, which is the top point for the swing, is where it's literally swinging from. That has to be at exactly the right height from the stage. Otherwise, the swings don't swing in time with the music. And so that's a little sort of technical fact there, that wherever this show is played in the world, that's the one measurement that literally cannot change. Otherwise, that number, you know, if the swings are out of time with the music, it's awful.
Let's have another quick piece of music. Let's fit in another piece.
Yeah, well, here I am back at the Metropolitan Opera.
Oh.
And it's Mozart, Marriage of Figaro, Act 3, The Countess. And again, this is just, Figaro is a sort of beautiful, madcap sort of farce. And everybody's changing costume and hiding and being discovered.
Impossible.
And it's a sort of crazy, sort of brilliant fun and mind-bending that Mozart was at it with all of this. And then you get to Act 3 and the Countess is on her own and you get this Dove Sono and it just breaks your heart. I mean, I could go on, but I think we should just play it and just let it clear the air.
Oh.
such a beautiful aria, Dove
Sono. Amazing.
And the lovely voice of Dame Kiru Takane. Yeah. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah,
exquisite. And in amongst all the craziness of that.
that opera. Yeah, yeah. It was another choice of my guest on People of Note, Rob Howell, who's a British costume and set designer responsible for Matilda, running here at Artscape. One of the things, as you said, we're running out of time here, Rob, it seems to me to be quite a big cast.
It is. I mean, in terms of what the audience see, it isn't necessarily, I mean, it's on the large size, but it's certainly not the biggest you can find anywhere. But it gets more complicated offstage.
Okay.
Because we have youngsters in the show, and there are rules quite properly and regulations about how many times children can perform. And so,
yes, because you've got various performers, yeah, haven't you? That same,
yes,
Matilda, for example.
There's different Matildas, all great, by the way. There's different Erics, different Lavenders, and different Bruces. They're the sort of, obviously, Matilda is a key title role, but the other three parts are very important, mm-hmm, to deliver the voice of a young person next to the voice of an adult.
Oh,
and that's,
yes,
a sort of key theme in the story of Matilda, is Matilda being a young child facing up to the monster being Miss Trunchbull. And so it's important. We tried lots of different versions in the early days of the show as to how would we deal with the small person, big person, the monster and the child. And we tried puppets and we tried giant headdresses. And then, of course, we tried real children. And guess what? They're amazing. So, I think it would, for the producers, it would have been less of a headache had we used puppets, because puppets don't need feeding, accommodating, tutoring, and all the stuff that's going on off stage for the youngsters.
Right, absolutely. Of course, we don't realise that, do we? We
no.
come to the theatre, transported,
yeah,
by this, and then go home.
Well, if anything were to go wrong on stage during the show, there's already somebody ready to go on to be the person that's had a problem. And that's true of the children as well. So you're seeing one Matilda perform tonight. There's another one in the building ready to go. And, you know, for somebody who might be 9 years old, that's a big deal.
Yes, of course.
To come in hoping, actually, that you're not going to go to work tonight. But in the darkness, somebody could say to you, there's a problem, you've got to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly brave.
My goodness. You know, Rob, what struck me is the incredible warmth and enthusiasm you've spoken about the show. And you've been involved with it for a long time now. And I'm interested that, as you said, none of you have had terrible fights.
No, we're all still friends.
Which
isn't that amazing?
Something for the show, doesn't it?
I think, you know, I think it does. I'm not. It's not just me being sort of cosy. It's just. It's very rare.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of it. I'm proud that that's a fact.
Good. Well, we're being treated at the Theatre in Cape Town. And when you go back, what's your next big project?
Next thing I'm going to do is I'll probably go back out to New York, where there's a production of a play that I designed called The Ferryman, which is a Jez Butterworth play. We opened it at the Royal Court in London. It was very, very popular, and then it moved on into the West End, and now it's on Broadway, and it's going to lead me into my final bit of music.
Oh,
if
yes,
that's okay.
So something a little unexpected
for a bit of variety. We've had a couple of bits of Matilda and Tim Minchin and the Metropolitan Opera, and I thought I'd bring this along because Jez's play has a very short prologue scene which is set in an alleyway, and then we move from that alleyway into a kitchen, a rural sort of farmhouse kitchen, and because of the way he's written it, there's a very, very short space of time to achieve the scene change, which I have to do. Not physically every night. I don't have to do that. Other people do that. But I have to come up with it, how it's going to work.
Right, right.
And originally, Jez had written that during that scene changes, he wanted the Rolling Stones, a track called Midnight Rambler, playing. And Midnight Rambler's a very long 7-minute track. And that's great for me, because I thought, well, I don't need 7 minutes for a scene change, but Jez is clearly thinking that Rob has got time. And then part of the way through the writing process, he changed his mind. Didn't want Midnight Rambler anymore. And he wanted Street Fighting Man, which is what we're going to hear now. And I brought it along because the first 15 seconds is actually all I had. So there's 5 seconds, and there's a drum beat. We have to go to blackout on that drum beat. Then I think there's a further 9 or 10 seconds when the audience have to see the kitchen, the farmhouse kitchen.
Yeah.
Then after about 15 seconds, and no more, the lead character has to be singing along to this track as if it's being played on the radio in the kitchen.
Oh, I see what you mean.
So if I'm not out of the way in 15 seconds, we don't start well.
Okay.
So as you're listening to this, just bear in mind the first 15 seconds.
Rob, best of luck, and I hope you get to relax and see some of the country.
Yes.
And that you'll come back again sometime.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
My guest on People of Note this week, Rob Howell, the British costume and set designer of Matilda. And here, the Rolling Stones. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Tureen Productions.
It's the return of a Christie for Christmas as Peter Tureen presents Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, in which West End star Mark Winter heads a cast of unusual suspects. Cut off by the snow, the guests uncover a murderer. Who can it be? From the 5th of December to the 19th of January, come and see why The Mousetrap is still the West End's longest-running play. Suspect everyone. Book your seats today, only at Theatre on the Bay. FMR.